3CR would like to acknowledge the Kulin Nation, true owners, caretakers, and custodians of the land from which we broadcast. 3CR pays respect to elders past and present of the Kulin Nation. We recognise their unceded sovereignty.
This is 3CR Breakfast. Oh, yeah. Alternative news, analysis, and current affairs. Monday to Friday, 7 a.m. to 8:30 a.m.
Only double. Grab your pants.
Good morning, listeners. You are tuned in to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. This is Priya, and I'm here in the studio with Kate. Good morning, Kate.
Good morning, Priya, and good morning, everyone. How are you?
I'm doing okay. How about you?
I'm also doing okay. I had some good news throughout the week, so let's focus on some good positive news. One of my friend's cats was missing for 11 days.
That's so stressful.
And she came back, and she's okay.
Did she come back by herself?
She came back by herself.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, 11 days.
I feel like that cat needs a talking to.
Naughty, naughty.
Yes, I know. That's. Can you imagine just like the stress and the missing cat posters, and I can imagine there was a big search and this cat's just like, oh, hey, did you miss me? Like,
I've just been hanging out in someone's garage, you know.
Just chilling.
Yeah, making friends.
Well, I'm very glad that the cat has returned. We have a packed show today with some really important news that we're covering, including the ongoing fight back against the NDIS cuts. So first up, we hear from Oriella Williams, who is a co-organizer with the Protect Our NDIS Alliance National and Ganjin team. And Oriella caught up with me earlier in the week to discuss the ongoing fight back against massive cuts to the NDIS announced in this May's federal budget. Now, changes to the scheme have been brought to Parliament by the Albanese Labor government under the National Disability Insurance Scheme Amendment, securing the NDIS for Future Generations Bill 2026. And that's currently subject to an inquiry in Parliament. So Oriella and I speak about the inquiry, about the process of mounting a public campaign to put pressure on, led by the disabled community and advocates, and the importance of continuing the fight even though submissions to the inquiry have closed.
Next up, we're joined by Kate Seselja, who is the co-chair of Gambling Harm Lived Experience Experts. She's also the founder of the Hope Project Australia, a gambling reform advocate and recovery coach. Today, Kate joins us to talk about her experience with gambling harm, where reforms on poker machines are up to within the ACT. We'll speak a little bit about the Canberra Labor Club and also solutions preferred by the gambling harm lived experience experts to manage gambling harm associated with poker machines.
And after that, we are joined by Louise Byrne of the West Papua Women's Office to talk about the connections between Sugar Research Australia, the Indonesian sugar industry, and alleged rights abuses and illegal deforestation in Merauke, West Papua. Now, this follows reporting by Greenpeace, an investigation by Greenpeace, rather, in December 2025, and then more recent reporting in Deep Cut News in June of this year about relationships between the Sugar Research Company, Sugar Research Australia, which is an industry body from Australia, and the clearing of land to cultivate different sugarcane varieties in West Papua, which has resulted in massive deforestation and displacement of Indigenous West Papuans from their lands without their consent.
Finally, we're joined by Karina Lester, who is a Yanggunyara, a Noongar leader and second-generation survivor of British nuclear tests at Emu Field in South Australia. She's a senior Aboriginal language expert, anti-nuclear activist, and ICAN ambassador. Most recently, Karina has been selected as a commissioner for the Independent AUKUS Public Inquiry, and today we will speak with Karina about the impacts of the Emu Field nuclear tests, AUKUS-associated nuclear waste risks, First Nations people's concerns around AUKUS, and what the public inquiry is hoping to achieve.
Amazing. Well, stay tuned all the way up until 8:30. That's right. We are with you from 7 to 8:30 a.m. every Thursday morning, and we will be back to you shortly with the news headlines for today.
Do you want to come and take a look inside 3CR? Curious to see our studios and where your favorite radio program is produced? On Friday the 24th and Saturday the 25th of July, 3CR is running tours as part of Melbourne Open House 2026. The 45-minute tours will take you right through the station and into the studios, as well as provide history and details of our current programming and projects. Come take a look. To register, head to openhousemelbourne.org and search for 3CR. Melbourne Open House at 3CR, Friday the 24th and Saturday the 25th of July. See you then.
Hello, you're listening to 3CR Community Radio 855. It is currently 7:07 a.m. and these are the news headlines for Thursday the 16th of July. Senators are calling on Gillian Siegel to the Special Envoy to combat anti-Semitism to correct claims she made to the Royal Commission that figures of Palestinian deaths in Gaza were, quote, grossly inflated, end quote. Legal experts have warned that knowingly providing false or misleading evidence to a Royal Commission breaches the Royal Commission Act and could carry legal consequences for Siegel. Multicultural Affairs Minister Anne Alley, who oversees Siegel's role, has not responded to questions about the claims amidst ongoing criticism over the government's approach to anti-Semitism policy and the Royal Commission's handling of evidence.
In other news, Prime Minister Albanese has announced plans to speed up approvals for data centres, despite acknowledging the significant pressure the facilities place on land, water and clean energy resources. The federal Labor government announced an Office of Artificial Intelligence to sit within the Prime Minister and Cabinet, but also announced a delay in artificial intelligence legislation until 2027, which critics say leave communities and the environment without adequate protections. Advocates are calling for a moratorium on new data center approvals until enforceable regulations are in place.
Also in headlines, a new report from the Grattan Institute says the Pharmacy Guild of Australia exerts excessive influence over pharmacy funding negotiations. The report highlights how negotiations take place behind closed doors, with no external scrutiny and little transparency about the evidence used to make decisions, resulting in agreements with the federal government that drive up costs of medicines for patients while limiting competition.
And finally in headlines, hundreds of people are expected to gather on Arna Country in Mbantwa Alice Springs from July 18th for the Close Pine Gap Sacred Land Back Convergence. Those gathering are calling for the closure of the United States Military Intelligence Base, an end to the Australia-US government's alliance, and the return of the land to Arna custodians. Organisers say the event, which marks 60 years since the Pine Gap Agreement was signed, will be the largest protest against the facility in decades. These have been the news headlines for Thursday the 16th of July, and you're listening to 3CR on 855 AM.
The People's Record is a podcast that looks at race, policing and public housing. Over 5 episodes, we speak with residents, lawyers, academics and activists about how policing has evolved and public housing communities are targeted. Listen to us on 3CR in August.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:10 in the morning and we are heading into our first segment for today, where I was joined earlier this week by Oriella Williams, the co-organizer with Protect Our NDIS Alliance National and Meganjin team. We spoke about the ongoing fight back against massive cuts to the NDIS announced in this May's federal budget, where changes to the scheme have been brought to Parliament by the Albanese Labor government under the National Disability Insurance Scheme Amendment, securing the NDIS for Future Generations Bill 2026, which is currently subject to an inquiry by the Senate Community Affairs Legislation Committee. Now, we talk about the inquiry process, the public scrutiny and concerns with the bill, and the fight back against cuts to the NDIS led by the disabled community and advocates, and why it's so important to keep the pressure on. Oriella is a proudly disabled Lebanese non-binary dyke based in Meganjin or Brisbane, and Auriella has lived experience as an NDIS participant themselves with high physical disability and psychosocial support needs, being a full-time power wheelchair user, requiring daily caregivers, and living in specialist disability accommodation or supported independent living. As well as being a dedicated community organizer and activist, Auriella is a passionate disability justice advocate, lived and living experience peer worker, and trained alt-to-sue facilitator with a focus on anti-carceral, peer-led, and trauma-informed responses to distress. First of all, Auriella, thank you so much for making the time to speak with me.
Thank you so much, Priya. So lovely to be here with you today.
Of course. And you know, I really appreciate the chance to have a conversation about this because our show has been following what's been happening with proposed cuts to the NDIS over the past few months, and a lot has happened since the start of the year. So can you take us through a brief timeline of events since the announcement of NDIS cuts in the lead up to the federal budget in May to where we are today?
Yeah, so the NDIS bill was announced with the budget by Jim Chalmers. I'm based in McGanagin and he's in Queensland, and quite terrible that that was announced. I did watch that budget live, and with that budget being announced, my heart just sank, not just for myself as an NDIS participant, but for my community, knowing real, like, tangible impacts of, like, what that bill will do and genuinely the harms that this proposed bill would have on the community. It's going to kill people. If this bill was to pass, this bill would kill people. And I don't think the government acknowledges that. And when Mark Butler was on Insiders recently, he was asked the question of, do you think people will die? And he went, no. And I don't think that he tangibly actually understands the real world costs of disability. Yes, disability is expensive, but we deserve to live full autonomous lives, regardless of cost. And then where we are at now is we've gone through an extension. The bill was meant to go through the Senate and be voted on July 1st. We've been lucky that the Greens have been able to secure an extension till August 14th. And there's been over 4,500 submissions that have been sent to the Senate inquiry. We had previously 3 days of Senate hearings. I did attend one of those sessions in NAM on behalf of Protect Our NDIS Alliance, and there will be further Senate hearings on the 30th, the 31st of July and the 6th of August. And now us as a community, like, having that power, having that strength in numbers, securing and putting pressure on the government to really understand that we will not go without a fight. We will not go down and let this bill pass. This bill must be scrapped in its full entirety. This bill cannot pass at all.
Yeah, and even with that inquiry, there was such a community fight to ensure that people had enough time to respond. Now, apart from the extension to the inquiry and the government being able to hear more from the disabled community about what this bill will do, the Greens have also worked to negotiate some changes to the NDIS bill. But of course, advocates still have serious concerns about the contents of the bill and about a lack of information about the bill's consequences. So what are some of your main concerns with the NDIS bill in its current form?
The bill as a whole must be thrown out of Parliament. I do not think that this bill should pass. Having, you know, been in the Senate hearings and having presented evidence and having heard very many harrowing stories of how the NDIS is currently functioning and cuts are already happening to NDIS participants, myself having faced things, cuts to my own plan and restrictions to my own plan, the government not understanding how it's implemented on a day-to-day basis and the supports we do need. But hearing harrowing stories through this 3 days of Senate hearings we've already had was heartbreaking and gut-wrenching. And I think the government really needs to take a look at itself. The Labor government really needs to take a good, hard look at itself and really understand that we are not their sacrificial lamb. We are not a group of people that is just, okay, cool, we're going to take these cuts and just lie down with it. No, like, we are a group of people that deserve the right to live, the right to dignity, the right to autonomy, the right to access safe and secure levels of care. And we deserve support that is within our autonomous levels of choice and control. The NDIS is a lifeline for myself and for many participants. It is a way that I was able to leave hospital after many months in hospital, stuck there without adequate levels of support, to be able to get back into the community and have a safe discharge. And with that being said, like, my current concerns are, like, although the Greens have been able to secure amendments to the bill, these amendments are not adequate enough. They do not safeguard participants enough. They don't have adequate enough changes to this bill tangibly to really, like, stop the harm that is going to happen. Like, it's a guaranteed outcome that people will die and harm will occur, people that will end up in hospital, and costs will be shifted to other sectors, to the healthcare sector, to, like, I faced almost being, like, ended up in an aged care facility. We might see more young people end up in aged care facilities, because where else do we go without adequate NDIS supports? Where else do we go? This bill cannot pass because there are not enough changes, and it, from what we know about the Labor government, they are not willing to make any further amendments. They are not willing to make any further changes. So with that being said as well, how are we going to exist safely and with autonomy and dignity if the government isn't willing to actually listen to us, to actually hear the evidence that we presented over 3 days of Senate hearings, over 4,500 submissions? We've had to share our stories over and over and over, and that is not being listened to. And the most frustrating thing is we've faced this with the Disability Royal Commission. Barely anything has been implemented, if at all, from the DRC. So if there are not adequate safeguardings that the government is willing to implement from the DRC, and the government is ignoring all evidence, all submissions, everything that is presented in front of them from the Senate inquiry thus far, this bill must be thrown out, because there isn't anything that the government is willing to do. This is why also we need to keep community pressure on, why it's imperative we need to work collectively and collaboratively to put pressure on the government, to get the government to understand, because currently they aren't listening to us.
I want to come back to what you mentioned about how the bill needs to be scrapped because there's no amount of amendments that are going to fix it. We're talking about changes to eligibility criteria, changes to people's access to funding, social community participation funding, changes to decision-making and automation, changes to ministerial powers, changing the definition of permanent disability. Is there anything in there that you want to speak to about the sorts of impacts that this stands to have for the community?
This whole bill is going to significantly impact the disability community. Like, we are already exhausted having to fight and advocate and share our stories of harm and ableism and abuse and neglect, and to specifically talk on the fact that also that the right to appeal being removed from in this bill, like, that is a proposed thing, and that's something that I'm hearing, like, the government is not willing to budge on our right to, like, appeal decisions that are made for us without us in consultation. That we see many cases, and I've also experienced this myself as an NDIS participant, where evidence and reports are handed to the NDIA and then they just do not listen to it, or they take it into little regard. Or we heard a lot in the Senate hearings from the Royal Australian Council of GPs that the evidence from GPs is not being listened, and that's something I've faced firsthand myself, that evidence from, like, different specialists, and being a GP is a specialty, is not being heard. So how will the NDIS function if it already is struggling to, like, function in its current form, and there are already cuts happening to disabled people? And again, I've faced that in aspects of what this bill is going to do is just going to cause blanket, like, extreme levels of harm that I don't think the government cares about or really even wants to listen to. And then with the government changing the definition of permanency and disability, like, that would require people to go undergo treatments and things that they otherwise may not work for them, may not need to, maybe restrictive practices, we may see, like, medication being forced onto people. Like, the government, even with these amendments, and the Greens have discussed amendments around things such as treatment and restrictive practices, is not extensive enough. We've seen with the amendments to permanency of disability, the way that that's been inclusive as well is, like, they must be publicly funded service available through Medicare, but or pharmaceutical benefit scheme or public health system, but waiting times exist. Many disabled people are going to be absolutely impacted by waiting times for the public health sector. I myself have to wait, like if I'm at a CAT 2, which is meant to be seen within 90 days of your referral going through within the public health sector. That's not something that happens. Like, I still end up waiting a year or like longer than that for something that's categorized the second most urgent referral category within the public health sector, at least in Queensland. So people are going to be impacted by wait times and things that are beyond their control. We are a demographic that the government wants to just put blanket cuts on to save funding, to save the budget. And you can't put the budget into a surplus, but they're putting people's lives in harm's way. It's not fair. It's not something we didn't ask to be disabled. We didn't ask to have to be NDIS participants, but I'm grateful that it enriches my life and allows me to live my life with choice and control and autonomy. And seeing this bill pass would cause so many people to die.
Public transport's great.
What's not great is that unless you've got a radio with you, you can't listen to 3CR when you're on it.
Until now, the Community Radio Plus app lets you listen to us wherever you are.
Get on board and search Community Radio Plus wherever you get your apps.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and we're in the middle of a conversation with Auriella Williams, who is a core organizer with the Protect Our NDIS Alliance National and Maganjin team. And we've been talking about the ongoing fight back against cuts to the NDIS announced in this May's federal budget. It's really a case of moral and ethical failure when we are weighing up putting the budget into surplus versus the quality of life, the dignity, the autonomy of disabled community members. And I wanted to ask you as well about the prospect of so many people being forced to exit the scheme or prevented from entering it. What's going to happen to foundational supports for people?
So the current estimates state that in the published FOI, by 2031, 241,000 disabled people will be removed from the NDIS. And then a further 106,000 people, their access will be refused and denied to the NDIS. That is catastrophic. That is like an astronomical level of disabled people that need support that are being denied and removed and targeted. And we have 5.5 million disabled people in this country. About 760,000 of us aren't NDIS participants. The number of disabled people in the country being 5.5 million to number of NDIS participants, it shows me that there actually aren't enough disabled people being adequately supported in this country. And by cutting like 241,000 disabled people from the scheme and then further 106,000, like, it's only going to impact other sectors, such as the healthcare sector, such as the aged care sector, such as, like, disproportionately, like, mob and CAL communities, myself being CAL and queer. Like, it's something that I have significant concerns about as well for mob and receiving culturally safe and appropriate supports. This is something that can't be met adequately within foundational block-funded systems. We don't have any idea of how these foundational systems will be actually implemented. My state, Queensland, hasn't signed on to Thriving Kids. Thriving Kids is meant to come into play in October of this year and is meant to be up and running. So really, what is the government's like idea of providing adequate support to disabled people when we have such a high number of disabled people that aren't already being adequately supported, then also removed from the scheme? Another important thing to mention is that state and territory disability ministers did make a joint submission to the Senate inquiry and examining like the NDIS bill and stating that the government's like proposed NDIS bill is filled with so much risk and so much harm. It's the fact that there are no current up and running foundational supports that haven't been tried, tested, and done in consultation and collaboration with the disability community. We have had no say on what these supports really look like, how they are going to impact us, what we can achieve and receive with these kinds of supports, and especially as well, what level of culturally safe and appropriate supports are we able to access with these supposed foundational supports that don't even exist, that aren't even running, that don't even have, we have no indication of the level of support that we will be able to access. And then what level of impact is this going to have on parents, carers, on the community, on the economy as well? Because the other aspect of things is cutting funds from the NDIS is only going to impact workers and only going to impact the economy tenfold. For every dollar that is spent by the NDIS, $2.25 goes back into the economy. And then workers are going to leave the scheme. Workers are going to lose their jobs because participants have lost funding. There's not going to be enough funding out there to support people. We are then, as participants, going to lose skilled, trained workers, allied health professionals, people that are imperative and put into our daily lives that keep the scheme up and running. The scheme won't be functional because of cuts to participants' funding, because of cuts to participants' lives, because the participants have died.
It's not just that you have lost access to skilled workers or that you stand to lose access to skilled workers, but you stand to lose access to, and this is already happening, to workers of your choice that you feel comfortable with and that you have a rapport with and that you know, understand how to meet your needs.
Exactly. As someone who is a high support needs disabled person, I am a hoist transfer, which requires two caregivers every day. It means I also need support in meal preparation. I'm a power wheelchair user. I need a lot of support with all of my ADLs, which is activities of daily living, and just basic toileting, showering, care needs to live my life with dignity. And I am able to choose who is touching my body, who is like up in my business in the most like intimate parts of my daily life, and not being able to have a choice over that, as like for me was very difficult when I spent a lot of time in hospital, and then when I was discharged, and having the ability to have the choice was so liberating, was also so freeing, was also like able to have supports that are trauma-informed, culturally aware, that are trained, have the right safeguardings in place. I'm someone with a catheter. Having people that have that training and knowledge around catheter-related care is imperative. And just having someone show up and be like, yep, cool, I'm going to just give you a shower. I don't know anything about them. Building that relationship, that working relationship with your supports is such a huge part of dignity. It's such a huge part of my daily life. And having that regularity and familiarity with my supports is a huge part of how I feel safe in my own body, how I feel comfortable and dignified as a disabled person. I need more support than an able-bodied person to be able to get up and out of bed and just get into my wheelchair and get into the community. But that doesn't make me less. That doesn't make me anything lesser than anyone else just because I need that support. And the government's cuts and proposed bill, it demonizes the fact that I need support like that to live my life. We are heading back into times of eugenics and institutionalization and pushing this narrative that disabled people cost a lot of money, then like it's wrong because we need this support to live. And we also look at the cuts to SCCP, which is social community and participation funding. Social community participation funding isn't just used to, as per the Australian Financial Review headline, which was the very sensationalized headline, such as using it for the movies and doing big shops and blah, blah, blah. Like it's not rooted in the reality of how disabled people utilize their supports. Supports are funded to the worker. Like this is how people are paid. NDIS supports are how people are paid. This is not something I actually receive. I don't receive any of the funds like directly from the NDIS. I pay my workers through my plan manager who pays the invoices. This whole sensationalized idea of how funding, social community participation funding is spent is so wrong because it for me, that looks like using it to go to the grocery store and going out to just be with friends, but like I need support to maybe go to dinner and my support worker needs to cut up my steak or my dinner because I physically may not be able to do that sometimes. And I need the physical, tangible support to be able to do things with my friends that I'm paying for as a participant. And there's another thing, which is companion cards. And I am lucky to be a companion card holder. Many disabled people are not able to be companion card holders because the eligibility criteria is very strict. So like disabled people, most of the time, majority of the time, are still also paying for their support workers to be able to go to the movies, be able to go to concerts. They are still paying for those things to be able to have support and be appropriately and safely supported in the community if they don't have access to things like companion cards. So this whole narrative is wrong. This bill does not tackle fraud. This bill does not tackle anything to do with fraud and rorts within the NDIS, and that is something that does occur, but this bill tackles none of that. This directly targets and impacts disabled people.
Protect Our NDIS held a forum this week discussing the cuts with experts and advocates from around the country. For people who weren't able to join, what were some of the standout moments for you from the forum?
Yeah, we were really lucky to have such an incredible lineup of presenters on this week's forum. We had Cassie Murphy from Mob for Mob, which is one of the peak bodies for mob and disability advocacy in Queensland. And really, the most imperative part of that is highlighting the actual tangible impacts and disproportional impacts this will have on mob. There is no mention in this bill of what culturally safe and appropriate supports will tangibly look like. And then also Ange from Emparo also speaking about that as well. And Emparo has a focus on supporting CAL communities, CAL disability communities. And myself, as someone who has a CAL background, I do resonate with that of like, really, there is nothing in this bill of what culturally safe and appropriate supports will look like. What will closing the gap really look like for First Nations communities and disabled First Nations people? Like, there really is nothing. There was nothing in Mark Butler's speech about that. There was nothing in anything in terms of directly in the Senate hearings about that. So really, there is no focus and understanding of like the actual harms and disproportional impacts that this bill will have on First Nations communities and CAL communities. And it is really disappointing that the government has no mention of that as well. And we were lucky to have also QAI, Queensland Advocacy for Inclusion, spoke about what the actual bill itself really does look like and what also these amendments do look like. And then Jordan Siljohn, who joined us, he is the Green Senator for Disability and is on the Senate inquiry team and really just asking questions about what this bill and these amendments do actually look like and the impacts of that. With the forum, though, we will have that up on our socials in the next week or so, hopefully by the end of the week, not too sure, but yeah, we'll have that up soon.
And we will share information about your socials as well, about Protect Our NDIS, so that people can access the recording and further information once it's up. But just to wrap up, how can people lend their support to the campaign? I know that Protect Our NDIS has a National Day of Action on the 1st of August, but what else can people do apart from showing up to actions in their area?
Absolutely. So yeah, we do have an action coming up, National Day of Action on the 1st of August. More will be announced soon with that one. But the most important thing is we need politicians to know how many of us will not vote for them if they pass this bill. Labor have shown us that they aren't going to listen to the evidence, that they aren't the only decision makers really here. Liberal and independent senators are the people that need to hear our stories, really need to hear what the impacts this bill will have. They are the ones that, you know, can make changes to this bill, and they need to be called. And you need to call Liberal and independent senators as many times as you can. We do have a calling guide that is in our link tree, and it does have phone numbers and things and a script you can also follow when calling Liberal and independent senators. And the focus is there is to put the pressure on and get them to understand the impacts of this bill. We also do have in our link tree, there is a template from Every Australian Counts, and then that is a direct email template to Liberal senators and ways you can sort of also get involved in terms of emailing and putting pressure, because the Senate inquiries written submissions deadline passed on the 10th of July. put that energy you would put into a submission into emailing Liberal and Independent senators. Put that pressure and energy into calling Liberal and Independent senators. They need to hear our stories and they need to hear our experiences, but they also need to hear not just from disabled people, they need to hear from allies, our friends, our carers, our support workers, allied health and treating professionals, small businesses, literally everyone that can share their stories and their impacts and perspectives of what this bill will do and the harm that this bill will cause. And Liberal and Independent senators must know that, because it seems like Labour ones aren't going to budge. So we need to put so much pressure on from the community. We got an extension by putting pressure on the government thus far, and we need to keep putting pressure on. And our strength comes in numbers. So show up on August 1st, call Liberal and Independent senators, email them, do what you can. We need to show up and show them how many of us that we are willing to fight. We aren't going down without a fight. We aren't going to go down without this bill being scrapped. We are not going to let our community be put in harm's way. We are not going to let disabled people die. But I also want to quickly just say as well that there is hope. There is so much hope in community. There is so much hope in us collectively joining together to fight on the streets, to fight together and fight and do what we know best, which is be vocal and be loud and be together, because the disability community has fought so hard to get our rights, to get this far, and we cannot give up.
You're listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. And that was Auriella Williams, who is a co-organizer with the Protect Our NDIS Alliance National and Maganjin team. Auriella spoke with me earlier this week to discuss the ongoing fight against massive cuts to the NDIS announced in this May's federal budget. Now, we talked a bit about the inquiry that is ongoing by the Senate Community Affairs Legislation Committee into the NDIS bill. And while submissions have closed for that inquiry after an extension to last Friday, the 10th of July, as Auriella said there, the imperative thing to do at the moment is to make sure that Liberal and Independent senators are aware of your concerns about these proposed cuts. As Auriella mentioned as well, there have been attempts to amend the bill and some changes made by the Greens, but the Labour government still doesn't appear to be listening to the disability community and to advocates. So, for more information about how you can support the fight back, including templates for calling Liberal and Independent senators and emailing them, we will have the link in our show notes to the Protect Our NDIS Alliance's link tree, where those templates that Auriella mentioned are located. And again, Auriella is a proudly disabled Lebanese non-binary dyke based in Maganjin, Mianjin, Brisbane, and they have lived experience as an NDIS participant with high physical disability and psychosocial support needs. They are a full-time power wheelchair user and require daily caregivers, and they live in specialist disability accommodation or supported independent living. And as well as being a dedicated community organizer and activist, Auriella is a passionate disability justice advocate, a lived and living experience peer worker, and trained ALT-TSU facilitator with a focus on anti-carceral, peer-led, and trauma-informed responses to distress. It is 7:38 in the morning, and again, you are listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM.
Hi, I'm Jeffrey.
I'm Alphonse.
I'm Erwin.
And we are from the Voice of West Papua.
Tuesday, 6:30 until 7:30 p.m.
News and music from West Papua.
Justice, diversity, community, politics, sport.
Join us every Thursday afternoon at 4 p.m.
No. We now start at 3:30 for an hour.
For the Sporting Record.
Or check out the Sporting Record podcasts available on Spotify, Apple, 3cr.org, wherever.
Baseball. Basketball.
Hello, you're listening to 3CR 855 AM. It is 7:41 and we are about to have an interview with Kate Seselja. Please note, though, the following interview touches on gambling harm. If you or anyone you know needs support, you can call Gamblers Helpline 1-800-858-858 or go to gamblershelp.com.au. Now, Kate Seselja is the co-chair of Gambling Harm Lived Experience Experts, the founder of Hope Australia, a gambling reform advocate and recovery coach. She has also been appointed to the Ministerial Advisory Committee to implement gambling reforms within the ACT. Today, Kate joins us to talk about her experience with gambling harm, where reforms on poker machines are up to in the ACT, a bit about the Canberra Labor Club and solutions preferred by the gambling harm lived experience experts to manage gambling harm. Kate, thank you so much for being on the show today.
Not a problem.
I was wondering if we could start with poker. Poker machines are widely recognised as one of the most harmful forms of gambling in Australia. Now, as someone with lived experience of gambling harm who now shares their story to help others, could you tell us a little bit about your experience with poker machines and how they affected your life?
Well, at 18, I was blindsided by poker machines, thinking that just because they were available in every venue I went into as a teenager, that they must be safe, and I couldn't be more wrong. So when I engaged with it the first time, my boyfriend showed me how to use it. I pushed the buttons a couple of times and unfortunately I won, and that is the worst thing that can happen. That relationship then just absolutely hijacked my mind and body in a way that I didn't ever anticipate, and I stayed away from drugs knowing how addictive they were, and didn't know that a machine could be just as addictive as cocaine. This is designed that way. It is a product that has been engineered to change the behaviour of the user and condition them into addiction. And that is not just something that I experienced. We have been the nation leading gambling harm for decades, because poker machines have been available in New South Wales since the 50s, and other states, you know, adopted it once they saw, well, state governments saw how much states could make off exploiting their the people that lived there. So, yeah, unfortunately, that's been the sad reality of Australia, that poker machines have infiltrated most social spaces and making incredible profits for the owners of those machines and state governments.
And it's very interesting to, I guess, compare the way that yourself and the, I guess, let's say the gambling industry frame, you know, frame language and terminology around, you know, poker machines and gambling harm, and just the way that you framed it in a way that, you know, it's often like people are being targeted in a way to increase profits, you know, which is just, yeah, it's just very sad. And I was wondering if we could sort of then speak about, I guess, what has been done to try and minimise harm associated with poker machines. At the moment, there's major debate regarding federal Labor dragging its feet in implementing meaningful gambling reforms. A little bit less talked about are legislative reforms within the ACT, where the Labor Party has been in power for the last 10 years. I was wondering if you could give us an overview of reforms that have been introduced by ACT Labor over its consecutive terms to reduce the number of poker machines and address gambling-related harm. And in your view, how effective have these reforms been?
Yeah, well, state and federal governments have been dragging their feet, as I said, for a long time on addressing gambling harm holistically as a nation. But, yeah, I've been working across both jurisdictions, you know, as it becomes brought forward. So in the ACT, yes, for the last decade, I've been working with the ACT government to try and bring on reforms. And we were very close a couple of terms ago to getting some meaningful reforms across the line, and then they got killed off, unfortunately. But what's been proposed at this point in time is $100 a day loss limits that a person can set up to $1,000 per month. And we think this is not exactly in line with what public health experts were proposing, which was $100 a day, a maximum of $500 a month.
Mm-hmm.
But it is a significant reduction in what you can lose currently, which is anything you can get your hands on.
Mm-hmm.
There is no limit. So you, because there are $10 maximum bets, you can lose up to $6,000 in a half an hour. So it's a lot. And that, of course, is making the clubs jump up and down because they don't want to not be able to exploit people to the fullest extent. And at the end of the day, this type of legislation being put forward is a real contrast for the community to see clubs in the correct light.
Mm-hmm.
And what they are trying to protect, which is their ability to exploit people, not to protect consumers from a harmful product.
Mm-hmm.
And that's at the core of what I've been doing for over a decade, since almost taking my life in 2012, is I haven't been walking around going, we need to wipe gambling off the planet. The thing I've been trying to advocate for is consumer protections that should have always been in place with such a powerfully addictive, harmful product. And that goes across, you know, into federal with the online gambling space too, where it's just a free-for-all at the moment, and the industry knows it, and that they are able to capitalize on exploiting Australians to extinction. That's their business model, to use people to extinction. And that is horrific when you understand that fact and you see it. It's not just, oh, it's a harmless product, just go have a flutter. No, once you expose yourself to the machine or to an online gambling experience, you are creating a pathway in your brain that industry can exploit either that day or any day in the future. That's what people don't understand.
Yeah, and I imagine, as well as, you know, excitement and addiction that comes along with it, there's also like it's the potential to, you know, or if I am, you know, for example, struggling financially, it's the potential to, oh, I could get, you know, I could make some money off of this, and it could help improve, you know, maybe my circumstances or my life, is that sort of something that is also something that factors into, I guess, people and their behaviours with regarding poker yes. poker machines?
Definitely. It's the exploitation of hope.
Mm.
It sells hope in a way that is so predatory.
Mm.
And in a cost of living crisis, doesn't matter if you're a struggling student or, you know, a retiree or anyone just trying to make ends meet, tradies, they're just being exploited with the illusion of it being a solution to their financial stresses.
Yeah.
But it is a very, you know, if there is any air quotes win, it is the bait that keeps you, you know, perpetually tied to their product, and they know it.
Yeah. It's just a exploitation of hope is a very, you know, sobering way to think about this. It's very sad. Now, more recently, Kate, an inquiry into the ACT clubs industry was launched by the ACT government to examine how clubs could reduce their reliance on poker machines while continuing to provide community services. The inquiry's final report was released in May, and I'm just wondering if you could talk us through what the key recommendations were for reducing gambling harm associated with poker machines, and in your view, do they go far enough?
No, they don't. The key recommendations, I guess, were disappointing. Clubs, you know, took the inquiry as a box-ticking exercise. You know, like they went through the motions, but they have continually shown that they are not interested in actually reducing their reliance on exploiting human beings, that they spend all of their energy trying to maintain the status quo rather than actually invest in innovation and ways of being able to diversify revenue streams to support whatever they want to, you know, outwardly show to the public. But a lot of, you know, this is where it's very tricky landscape, because not all clubs are the same.
Mm-hmm.
But when it suits them, they all jump under the one umbrella and say, you know, well, this will mean this will go if you take away this revenue stream, or, you know, and there are mega clubs, and then there are small community clubs that are actually delivering services to the community, and it's not an equal playing field. So they need to be treated in the right context. And clubs that are actually delivering essential, you know, social activities or connection or sporting facilities to an area, I'm 100% on board with whatever the government can do to support that club in maintaining that bowling green or whatever it is that is essential space. But the mega clubs that aren't interested in actually, everything is window dressing for their core business, which is actually gambling harm. That needs to be seen in the correct light.
And when we speak about, I guess, the role of clubs and their, you know, some clubs may be genuinely interested in moving away from relying so much on revenue from gambling, and some others aren't. I was just wondering, so the ACT Labor quoted in 2022 that the government is committed to reducing harm from electronic gambling machines while supporting the sustainability of community clubs and the valuable contribution clubs make to the ACT community. Now, The ACT Labor Party operates clubs under the Canberra Labor Club Limited Company, which rely heavily upon gambling profits. In the 2024-2025 financial year, gambling profits accounted for 56% of the club's overall revenue. I'm just wondering if you feel this presents a conflict of interest in the Labor Party's attempts to balance the sustainability of clubs and manage gambling harm associated with poker machines.
It has and always will. You know, you can't... It's been the most frustrating space to be an advocate in, because where other issues of public health, you can go to a minister and have, you know, them take it seriously. It's been horrific. It doesn't matter whether I'm fighting state or federally. The government is so interwoven with gambling interests that it is compromised in its ability to respond to the public health crisis that it represents. You know, it presents. So it's just diabolical in how people need to understand gambling harm in the right context and push their elected representatives into responding in the whole community's best interest, not in what's the best interest of the party. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. It sort of pits interests, perhaps, against one another in a way, and the interests of different groups and parties in particular. Mm. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. It's a complex issue. I wish it was one product in one environment, but unfortunately, gambling has metastasized in myriad of forms, but the overall understanding people need to grasp is that Australian consumers are profoundly unprotected from gambling harm in all of its forms, because there hasn't been anybody in politically powered enough to do the work of protecting consumers. And I do commend Minister Patterson for these reforms that she's put forward. Can they be strengthened? Yes.
Yeah.
But it is a meaningful step forward in prioritising consumer wellbeing.
And in looking forward, Kate, If people were interested in finding out more about gambling harm lived experience experts' policy recommendations, where would they be able to find those?
If they contact glee.org, we have, you know, they can reach out and we can point them in whatever, if they're interested in knowing more about federal legislation, we can point them in that direction. If they want to know about what's happening in their state, we can point them in that direction. So just head to glee.org and Gambling Harm Lived Experience experts can connect you.
Amazing. And we can include that link in our show notes at the end of the show today, Kate. And thank you so much for speaking with us today, not only about your experience, but also the expert opinion of someone with lived experience on what reforms have or have not been implemented.
It's a national public health crisis, as I mentioned, and it cannot go unaddressed any longer. I mean, people's lives are at stake, and we lose two Australian lives a day to gambling-related suicide.
Oh, it's a sad statistic. But thank you very much, Kate. And the work that you do is amazing and incredible. And yes, it's been great having you on the show.
Thank you.
And And that was a conversation with Kate Seselja, who is the co-chair of Gambling Harm Lived Experience Experts, founder of the HOPE Project Australia, a gambling reform advocate and a recovery coach, talking about her experience with gambling harm and reforms on poker machines in the ACT. You're listening to Thursday Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM, and it is 7:59 in the morning.
Do you want to come and take a look inside 3CR? Curious to see our studios and where your favorite radio program is produced? On Friday the 24th and Saturday the 25th of July, 3CR is running tours as part of Melbourne Open House 2026. The 45-minute tours will take you right through the station and into the studios, as well as provide history and details of our current programming and projects. Come take a look. To register, head to openhousemelbourne.org and search for 3CR. Melbourne Open House at 3CR. Friday the 24th and Saturday the 25th of July. See you then.
Help us stay radical. Become a regular donor to 3CR. A regular donor is someone who loves 3CR so much that they set up an automatic donation to 3CR on the same day every month. 3CR is determined to stay independent. This means we don't rely on corporate sponsorship or government funding. We serve our community, not corporate interests. But this also means we do rely on people like you to keep the station running. From paying the bills to maintaining our studios to training the next generation of community broadcasters, 3CR relies on community donations to survive. By becoming a regular donor, you can help us stay resilient and radical. Will you help 3CR by becoming a regular donor today? Together, we can keep independent voices on air. Go to 3cr.org.au.
You are listening to Thursday Morning Breakfast on 3CR 855 AM. It is 8:01 in the morning, and a quick weather check. We are looking at a high of 15 degrees Celsius today, low of 10 degrees, and right now it's sitting at about 11.7 degrees in Narm. Now we are joined by Louise Byrne of the West Papua Women's Office to discuss the connections between Sugar Research Australia, the Indonesian sugar industry, and alleged rights abuses and illegal deforestation in Merauke, West Papua. In December 2025, Greenpeace published the report Sweet Promises, Bitter Reality Inside the Merauke Sugar Cane Project, detailing serious concerns about the role of the Indonesian state and agribusiness in land theft and mass deforestation in Merauke. And more recently, Royce Kermeloves of Deep Cut News has written about the connections between the Australian government-funded body Sugar Research Australia and land clearing in the region. Louise has been working for West Papua's freedom and self-determination since 1999 and helped found the West Papua office in Docklands in 2014. Good morning, Louise.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Good.
Well, let's jump right into it. Now, to give some context for this conversation, can you tell our listeners about the Merauke region and about some of the historical impacts of the food industry on Indigenous West Papuan communities there?
Yes, sure. Merauke is in the south of West Papua, so way over on the PNG border, and it's the traditional home and land of the Marind people. So historically, it was the Marind people's tribal god Bomai and his nephew Manu, who once took a maritime journey from Merauke all the way to Mur Island in the Torres Strait, and taught the islanders a way of living together rather than fighting. So he's their most influential god up there, and it's called Malo Bome. And we have the wonderful Melbourne scholar, actually, Dr. Nonnie Sharp, to thank for that information. Dr. Sharp was one of the drivers of the Mabo High Court decision in 1992. So that's one thing about Merauke. Then we can move quickly to World War One period, when the Spanish flu pandemic, so it was the last one before COVID, I think, or no, I think there was AIDS in between. Anyway, the Spanish flu killed 1 in 5 Marind Papuans. And as a result of that, and the Dutch who were the colonial presence at that time, didn't quite know what to do about the Spanish flu. It was all over the world, of course. So they made the Marind people move from their amazing longhouses, hundreds of feet long, to model villages where they had to live as nuclear families. Mm. So little huts on the either side of a skinny, narrow path, yeah? Mm-hmm. So that was a big thing about Meraki. Then the last thing historically about Meraki was after Japan took over West Papua during World War II, the Australians and the Americans built a massive war base that housed up to 7,000 troops, you know, airmen, sailors, land troops. There was heaps of activity there. And even Gough Whitlam, who was in the Australian Air Force at the time, spent time there. And the whole purpose of that base was to protect Port Moresby from the Japanese going occupying it through Torres Strait. So there's of all the places in Papua, Meraki is probably the one that is known best to Australians because of all that history.
Mm. And yeah, and now you know, the conversation we're having today is about the ongoing, I guess, intervention from people outside of the region in Meraki, and so here I want to turn to Indonesian agribusiness interests. How have agribusiness companies, and particularly the sugar industry, including subsidiaries of the Merauke Sugar Group, been implicated in, you know, this process of intervention of Marind lands?
Okay, intervention's a good word, but deforestation, decimation, ecocide, these are more descriptive words of what's actually going on there.
Mm.
It actually started under a previous president, SBY, if any of listeners remember him. He was back in 2004, I think. He's quite well known here because he came down here and spoke at the parliament. He was a military general. And he started the process of deforesting land in Meraki. Sorry, with money, actually, from, if my memory is correct, from it was Wahhabi money from Saudi Arabia. So it was mixed up, you know, like God knows. And it was a massive deforestation and rice planting, actually, back in those days. So anyone who sort of knows their history knows that the Dutch, who are very thorough, had surveyed the land in West Papua and found that only 5% of it was actually arable. So to sort of rip up the forest and the swamplands down in Meraki, and thinking that they were going to make enormous profits from rice, it was meant to be serving the Indonesian self-sufficiency in rice campaign, was ridiculous. Like a lot of Indonesian ideas, they sort of, you know, have a thought bubble and off they go. So that failed, but it only failed, you know, after the forest had been completely destroyed. And we've got drone footage of that terrible process where people who'd been living in the forest for centuries were shoved off and had to find other little homes further out. And so were the animals, like, you know, the cassowaries and things. So Sophie Chow has written a very thorough and readable anthropology of what happened in Meraki during that time. She's an Australian up in, she was at Sydney University. I think she's still there. And she actually went and lived with Marind in a Marind village for ages, maybe 2 years, and really got to know what was happening there. And the main thing is that people who lived in the forest, the forest was their supermarket, you know, and all of a sudden there was no place left to get food.
Mm.
Even, you know, cassowary started eating noodles. You know, like it was, it's just been terrible for the people, terrible for the environment, and quite impactful on climate change to lose that massive swathe of forest.
Yeah, absolutely.
So that was then. Now we've got another military president called Prabowo Subianto, who actually, you know, should have been put on trial for war crimes. Even the military sacked him. He was head of the military. And even they sacked him. So he had to escape to Jordan for 8 years. But he's come back. And with heaps of money, of course, and the Indonesian capacity to forget history, sort of the day after it happens, he was elected president. So he's got this, he's got onto this kind of agribusiness thing as well. So it's still rice, but it's also sugar. And with his great power, you know, and influence, I mean, his brother is one of the biggest oil barons in Indonesia, and it's his brother who funded his election campaign. He can put, he's pulled together all these barons, okay, and it's called the Merauke Sugar Group, but it's actually 10 companies, and often the key person at the head of each company doesn't put his name there. He uses his nephews, nieces, all sorts of relatives, so that as a way of masking, you know, their...
the connections.
Their presence, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
That's where Greenpeace did just really such an amazing job with their investigation, because they got photos of two of the biggest at the planting ceremony with President Jokowi, and at the planting ceremony of the sugar in Merauke in 2024.
Yeah. So, I mean, these connections, I think, are so well detailed in that report. And I did want to ask, with the time that we have left, about how that then connects to Sugar Research Australia, which is an Australian government-funded organisation operating as the declared industry services body for the Australian sugarcane industry. And that's come under scrutiny because of its agreement to supply six sugarcane varietals to the Merauke Sugar Group subsidiary, PT Global Papua Abadi, in 2024. So what do we know about this agreement and the implications for Australian involvement in this deforestation and dispossession?
Right. Well, we don't know much, as I'm sure if Greenpeace Indonesia couldn't get the details out, except for these two photos, which are so incriminating, you know, Australians can't do much better research than that. But what we do know is that there is a company in what's that place called? Cairns? Townsville.
Townsville.
Sorry, Townsville, yeah.
Wilmar.
Wilmar, okay. Now, it took over, I'm just telling you this, hang on. It took over, where is my notes? It took over CSR. Do you remember CSR?
Yeah, yeah.
The Sugar and Ethanol Division. And it bought it in 2010 for 1.5 billion Australian, right? Mm-hmm. So it now has 8 mills in Queensland and manufactures half of Australia's raw sugar. So in that same town, in Townsville, also there is the Sugar Research Australia has got a base. So there was, you know, this sort of connection. And Sugar Research Australia, who I'm sure are extremely embarrassed that they got involved, but they've been studying sugar sugar stuff, okay, for quite some time in Indonesia, because the little seedlings coming out of Java to all sorts of places in Indonesia, like Kalimantan and Sumatra, is diseased, right? And so I think the Sugar Research Australia was very worried that this conglomerate was going to be opening up sugar growing bases in Merauke, which is pretty close to Australia, right? Mm-hmm. So they I think, got drawn into it. I don't know. They've sort of gone completely silent on their involvement, but they got drawn into supplying the seedlings to the Meraki endeavour, which is, you know, the sort of the size of Bali. It's not just like a little paddock. So Wilma Sugar is actually owned by this guy called Martius Satoris. And Wilma Sugar and the other one involved, the big one, I can't remember its name, they have been tried and fined in Indonesia and in China for corporate fraud and systematic judicial corruption. Why we're leaving this Wilma Australia in Townsville alone and sort of uncritiqued is I've got no idea. I can't believe it.
There's serious concerns about what the connections are, even though, as you've mentioned, they're pretty opaque at the moment. Because we have to wrap up, I'm so sorry, Louise. Is there anything you want to leave our listeners with to let them know about how they can find out more and keep the pressure on?
Yes. Well, the best thing is just came into my inbox this morning. Two of the Indonesian organisations here in Melbourne, their students, Nong Krong and Begrak, they're showing Pastor Barbie, the wonderful Indonesian investigation, again on the 29th of July at the Eclipse Cinema in Wellington Street. And anyone who hasn't seen it, it's been shown here once in Melbourne and in Monash. Mm-hmm. I really recommend going there because it represents a massive collaboration by Indonesians like Greenpeace Indonesia, the Environmental Investigation Institute in the UK, and Indonesian, really experienced Indonesian activists. They're not young kind of beginners. And that was, it just opens your eyes. I mean, it's been completely locked down in Indonesia.
Absolutely.
Every time they try to have a showing. So, if you can't go on the 29th of July, it is on YouTube. Once it was blocked in Indonesia, the producer decided to put it up on YouTube.
Excellent.
Yeah.
I mean, that's important to get the word out. So encourage people to watch Pesta Babi and also to follow the work of West Papua Women's Office and also, the West Papua Freedom Movement.
The only other thing
movement.
I'll say, Priya, how much longer have I got? 1 minute?
Less.
Less. Okay. Australians, all right, I'm talking to you. We have to recognise West Papua's right to self-determination. Under international law, it's an Indonesian colony, and that is illegal.
Yes, absolutely.
So the Labor Party conference is coming up in Adelaide. Anyone going there, look, they can come to the office first and I'll brief them. I'll give them heaps of information.
Information in our show notes. So keeping an eye out for the Labor Party conference and making sure that people are putting the pressure on for West Papua to have its self-determination and sovereignty.
Yes, because once Australia shifts...
We got to wrap. Sorry, Louise. Thank you so much for your time.
All right.
Thank you. 3CR would like to thank our sponsors, Earth Greetings, cards that connect, care, and celebrate. Support wildlife and habitat with every purchase. Inspired by nature, giving back to the planet. Learn more at earthgreetings.com.au. All right, we might jump straight to our next interview. So thank you again to Louise Byrne of West Papua Women's Office talking about the connections between the sugar industry and rights abuses and illegal deforestation in Merauke, West Papua. We will have all the information in our show notes. Now, Kate, take it away.
Now, we will be speaking with Karina Lester, a young Yungyara Anangu, leader and second-generation survivor of British nuclear tests at Emu Field in South Australia. Please note, this conversation may mention First Nations peoples who have passed away. If you want to skip this interview, tune out for the next 15 minutes. Or if anyone needs support, MOB can call 139276. Now, Karina, to get started, thank you so much for being on the show.
No, thank you for having me.
So I just need to give you a brief introduction, actually. So you are a senior Aboriginal language expert, anti-nuclear activist, and ICANN ambassador, and most recently you've been selected as a commissioner for the Independent AUKUS public inquiry. I was just wondering if, to begin with, you could talk us through your experience as a second generation survivor of nuclear tests that were conducted 70 years ago by Britain at Emu Field, South Australia, and talk us through, I guess, how they and their aftermath have impacted your family, community and traditional lands.
Thank you, Kate. Big question.
Sorry.
It's a story that goes way back to 1953. My late father, Yami Lester, was a young fella then. It would have been around roughly the age of 12 when the first detonation of Totem 1 took place at Emu Field. And, of course, this was an arrangement between the British government and the Australian government to come and test, for the British government to come into Australia and test their nuclear weapons. The Emu Field test was the first mainland test that took place then on the 15th of October 1953. And that was what Dad witnessed as the young 12-year-old boy who was roughly 100, 120 kilometres north of that test site at his traditional lands on Yangundjara country at a place called Wallajara, or Wallatina is the English name for it. And he was there because his parents were living and working there on the pastoral property doing domestics and station work. So my grandfather worked on the pastoral property, working with the horses and the manager and mustering cattle and, you know, doing all that incredible work. And my grandmother was very much involved with Mrs. Cullinan, who was there at the time, you know, doing the domestics, the washing of the clothes and the dishes. And that's what they witnessed. That morning of the 15th of October, they heard two bangs. Mm-hmm. And then by late morning, or, you know, it was a morning test, so by late morning before lunch, they then noticed this black cloud rolling. I'm no physicist, but I would say being the distance that it was, it lost altitude. And as it fell to the ground, losing its altitude, it fell over the camp very heavily. And it was a black mist. Dad's memory of that morning was it was a black, thick cloud, like a mist, that sort of ran across the ground. And they were still living in traditional shelters, what we call gangul.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a number of these gangul's I still see today, around four of these old shelters in the sand dunes. And that's where they were. So there was no protection, real protection. And mm-hmm. through our stories and through what Dad eyewitnessed, there was panic in the camp.
Mm-hmm.
And our older generation, you know, started to show signs of this sickness, new sickness. Older generation, like great-grandparents, I speak of Nana Angelina Wanga, who spoke of burying her parents because they were quite elderly then.
Mm.
And then just the sickness that fell over the camp of people vomiting and skin rashes and diarrhea. Nana's testimony was saying it came with a really strong toxic smell. And that's what fell heavily over the camp. Mr. and Mrs. Cullinan at the time at the old homestead had louvers as their windows, and you could run your finger along there and pick up the black soot.
Mm.
That then, 30 years later, was what we found out through Dad's work through the Royal Commission, was radiation fallout that fell over Wallatina back in 1953. So Dad's eyesight went on him gradually. By the young age of 16, his world turned into complete darkness then because he lost all vision then. So that's what really changed, you know, in Dad's life, a huge takeaway, you know, from being a young man who had vision, who loved being on his traditional lands and
being on his country and working on the station. He really had a passion for that because it's what he saw and loved working with horses, and he was learning from his older generation as well. And then 4 years later, it was a gradual taking away of his sight. And then 4 years later, the last thing he saw was the red light from the doctors here in Adelaide on Kaurna country, where that was the last thing he saw, and that was it then. His world was in darkness then, at a very young age of, 16, which was really confronting. And I've a mother of four, and my youngest boy is 18. So he's, at that young age, you look at and you think that was very traumatic for Dad, and a huge adjustment then as a young boy to then adjust to a world of darkness. And he did spend a lot of time down here in Adelaide then.
And to be robbed of something without, thought being put into ramifications of the actions of tests is just, it's so many more ramifications as well is just, it's unthinkable almost. You spoke about your children and I guess your work probably I imagine your work to minimize the risks of nuclear like associated waste and harms significantly factors in their health and well-being. And I was just wondering, in your role now as a commissioner for the AUKUS Public Inquiry, what do we know about risks associated with nuclear waste from AUKUS, and what is the AUKUS Public Inquiry hoping to achieve around this?
Well, it's not that, it's the lived experience that always reminds everybody that this stuff is harmful. Mm. So all of us globally from affected communities, like this is a global issue, it's not just Australia's emu field issue and what happened with Arnoyuda in our area on country, on Yanguyada country. This is a global issue. And they tested in what they see, governments of the day, nothing's out there, isolated, very remote region. So, Emu Field was very remote in outback South Australia and the far north of the state of South Australia. But they tested then down at Maralinga Darajan then afterwards. So there was a huge testing program here in our own backyard in South Australia. But then you hear recently we remembered the traumatic experience from the Marshall Islands 80 years ago. They tested in the Marshall Islands because nobody was out there. Governments of the day, the US government of the day said, we'll test this and this is all good for the mankind. You're doing your part. They tested in our beautiful blue ocean, the Pacific Ocean. So it's a global issue. But where you look, where they tested, is where governments of the day thought nothing was out there. So it's not safe because we from those affected communities have often needed to remind everybody of those impacts felt by the tests that took place. And it's a very concerning issue because waste is an issue that's never been addressed globally as well. So there's a real concern with this AUKUS public inquiry that's happening. We're wanting to find out the waste issue and what is the plan for waste, and does this agreement also open it up for the United Kingdom to bring in their waste or for the United States to bring in their waste, and then where will it be? So, and where's that location? So there's a real concern for mobs across the nation. And I know mobs in South Australia, we're really worried about where this waste will be because we had a big push by Howard government in the late 90s. We had, again, another push in the sort of 2015 time where they looked at the nuclear fuel cycle. And again, that was all to do with nuclear waste and bringing in international waste. And South Australia was the hotspot. And so, governments of the day think because it may have been, it was tested on at Emu and Maralinga, it's already contaminated land. So therefore, let's continue to put more poison into that land. by allowing for nuclear waste to come in. Yeah. Nobody globally has got the textbook on how they're going to manage nuclear waste, full stop. Mm-hmm. Fukushima, an absolute disaster, and what is coming out of that is now being released into the beautiful Pacific Ocean. So there is no textbook. Those of us that have that lived experience, who have been there hearing the stories and the traumatic stories of our people and what we witnessed and what we experienced, are telling you that this is bad, this is catastrophic, yet there is no plan. And we still continue to play with this.
In pushing for, you know, the people with lived experience of this to contribute to hopefully, you know, some waste management policy, and how can people make submissions into the inquiry, or if they wanted to learn more about the AUKUS inquiry, how can they do so?
Yeah, people can jump on to the AUKUS Public Inquiry website. So just in your search engine, AUKUS Public Inquiry, that'll take you to our page. That gives you all the information. As much as we know around what this agreement means, it's, you know, it's in pillars. So pillar one is definitely focusing on the submarines, mm-hmm. and these are the nuclear-powered submarines. Pillar two is looking at artificial intelligence. And we're moving pretty quick here in South Australia around this AI and what we're going to be doing in those, you know, in the near future of setting these, you know, agencies up. Because here in South Australia, we have an AUKUS department. And just recently, hearing on the radio, there's a move now, and it's come from Canberra, of course, around artificial intelligence. Mm. And so what is it that we're doing as a nation to look at artificial intelligence? And I know South Australia has been talking of having one of those data spaces here in the mid-north region of South Australia. So there's a real concern. There's a real concern of, or lack of information. There's a lack of transparency, and I think we are asking those questions in the AUKUS public inquiry.
I'm very sorry to have to interrupt. I wish that we could continue speaking, and perhaps we can maybe get you in for another chat in the future so that we can dig into this more, but we do unfortunately have to wrap up in time for the next show.
Oh, good. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for being on the show, Karina. We very much appreciate it, and it was great speaking with you.
Enjoy your day.
You too. Bye.
And that is all we have time for on today's show. You just heard from Karina Lester, who is a Yankunyarra Anangu leader and second-generation survivor of British nuclear tests at Emu Fields in South Australia. Earlier in the show, we heard from Auriella Williams, who's a co-organizer with the Protect Our NDIS Alliance National and Maganjin team, from Kate Seselja, who's the co-chair of Gambling Harm Lived Experienced Experts, and from Louise Byrne of the West Papua Women's Office. We will catch you next week on Thursday Breakfast. Stay tuned now for Lost in Science.
3CR Breakfast would like to thank the New International Bookshop, Melbourne's radical bookstore and venue, for their financial support of this program. You can find Nibs opposite reception in the Lygon Street wing of Trades Hall Carlton. You can buy books online and keep up to date with upcoming events at nibs.org.au.